This is KFSK's Midday Magazine for Monday, July 11th. I'm Angela Denning. A petition seeking another vote on marijuana in Petersburg got enough required signatures and then some. 434 names were turned into the Petersburg Borough Friday. The signatures have been checked over and certified. Petitioners only needed 104 signatures to get the issue before voters. The question would ask voters if marijuana sales and grow businesses should be illegal in the Petersburg borough. If voters vote yes, it would prohibit marijuana sales, any marijuana product, and the operation of any marijuana establishment for growing, selling, or testing. If voters vote no, then things would remain as they are. The borough would continue to create local laws on how future marijuana businesses would be run. Currently, there are two businesses seeking a marijuana license from the state. One wants to cultivate marijuana near Papke's Landing, about 10 miles south of town. The other looks to sell marijuana from the back of a downtown restaurant. The petition misses the April deadline to get the question in the regular municipal election in October. So that leaves two options. The borough assembly could decide to add the question to the regular election ballot, or there will be a special election. According to the borough clerk's office, a special election costs between $6,000 and $10,000. Last year's municipal election saw a total voter turnout of 416. The Petersburg count in the state election that legalized marijuana was 614 yes votes and 438 no votes. 58% of local voters supported it. A man who's headed up two different churches here in Petersburg, flown float planes, and done the midnight shift as a local cop, has moved out of town this summer. Pastor Mike Schwarty is leaving the Petersburg Lutheran Church and moving with his family to be near Auburn University in Alabama. The 54-year-old Schwarty was a Catholic priest for 5 years, covering churches in Wrangell, Petersburg, and Cake, and flying a float plane back and forth between the towns. He also worked as a float plane pilot and wore a badge for the Petersburg Police Department. Joe Vicknicki sat down with Schwarty to look back on his time wearing a number of different hats in a small town.
And that's the reason you're going out, is for your wife, Ying, to take advantage of education down there?
Yes, she's been awarded an opportunity to pursue her PhD in business with a concentration in management. There's only four students selected. She was one of four from a deep applicant pool. And it was it's one of those, it's kind of like a half-court shot, Joe. Every once in a while, they'll go in. And she nailed it, and I couldn't be more happy for her and thrilled about this opportunity.
So you had to take it, pretty much.
Yeah, definitely. That is the definition of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, so... We're doing it. So it's bittersweet leaving. We love it here. We had plans on our girls graduating from high school here at Petersburg High School. It's a great school system. Yet it will be a wonderful opportunity for Ying. So
a new chapter for you.
Yeah.
You've been here how many years?
Well, I was assigned here originally by Bishop Mike Warfel in 1999, and so I served at St. Catherine's for 5 years. So I've been here in Petersburg for 17 years, and just loved it. It's just amazing how God is working.
During that time, you were also covering Wrangell's church as well?
Yep. I learned to fly as a Catholic priest, so I came here with the church's plane. It's a Cessna 182 on wheels, and I was here in St. Catherine's in Petersburg for half the week. Sunday morning, I'd go to the airport, fly to Wrangell. I'd have mass over there, and every other Sunday I'd go to Cake, and celebrate mass on someone's dining room table over there, and then I did that for 5 years. So it was great. I just love the people in both communities. So I love being a priest. I was a Catholic priest for 10 years, and then I went to Bolivia on a sabbatical. And that was that was 11 years ago, and that's when I met my wife Ying. We've been together ever since, Joe.
And after that, I'm trying to remember, you were a police officer briefly.
Yes, yeah, so I resigned as a priest once we got married. But before I left, Rod Judy, God bless him, he offered me a flying position at Pack Wing, full-time year-round, before I even left here. So it's just one of the many ways God was blessing us with opportunities. So I flew for Rod for a while, and then Ying came back. Ying was a dispatcher at the Temsco helicopter up there, and that's how we started. We got here 11 years ago. Everything we owned was in a little car, and that was it. And so I flew that full season in 2006, and then my wife went to the police department to get a driver's license, and that's when Dale Stone approached me and asked me if I would consider being a police officer. And I never did until then. And that worked out great. It was a wonderful 2.5 years. I got trained to teach the DARE program, the Drug Abuse Resistance Education. So I loved doing that, and it exposed me to really everybody in Petersburg. I got to visit people that I don't normally see to experience the nightlife. So that was great. As a matter of fact, when I was a priest, I thought, you know, I ought to spend more time in bars, because that's what the Lord would do. Mm-hmm. He would do that. So I was a police officer, and I'd have the graveyard shift, you know, the midnight shift, and I'd do the bar checks, and it was so much fun. People would say, Father Mike, what are you doing here? You know, they would ask me. I was like, well, what are you doing here? So that was great. It was a wonderful time serving in that capacity. So I never thought I'd be a police officer, but I'm excited. I'm glad I had that opportunity.
It certainly broadened your horizons.
Yeah, it was a neat experience. Really amazing. And then we were worshiping at the Lutheran Church all the while, and bought a little house on Lake Street, and then the Lutheran Church called me to be the pastor. So, Joe, I literally went from my police uniform. My last day was February 6th. The next day, Saturday, February 7th of 2009, I was at a church council retreat for Petersburg Lutheran Church. And then the 8th of February 2009 was my first Sunday in the pulpit there, and that started the ministry. And then February 9th, the next day, 2009, my daughter Joy turned 2. And she's 9 now.
Wow.
It's amazing to see the growth in children. It kind of makes you wonder, you know, what's happening to us?
Time goes by fast.
Time goes by.
Mike Schwarty and his family left town July 2nd for Auburn, Alabama. There is a longer version of this interview on our website, kfsk.org. An affordable cottage neighborhood on Halibut Point Road in Sitka took another step toward reality with the help of almost $250,000 in grant funding. The Rasmussen Foundation last week awarded $234,000 to the Sitka Community Land Trust to break ground on 6 small homes on property formerly known as the Old City Shops. Robert Woolsey reports from Sitka.
Randy Huey is president of the board of the Sitka Community Land Trust. He's clearly pleased to have received a boost from Rasmussen, but he's not surprised. He thinks land trusts make sense in a big state where land is tight.
But the Rasmussen Foundation believes it to be a model that will serve the state of Alaska, particularly because so much of the state is owned by government entities. The federal government, state government, and city governments own a tremendous amount of land. They can put that land in a land trust and devote it to affordable housing perpetually.
The Old City Shops have been out of service for over 20 years when they were replaced by new facilities on Jarvis Street, and Mother Nature sealed the deal in 2005 when overburden deposited by the construction of Edgecombe Drive 3 decades earlier came down in a mudslide, destroying the state maintenance building. Huey said a lot of this funding will go toward preventing a repeat of that partially man-made disaster.
And we're going to clear that out and scrape that bank back and put a rock retaining wall of some size to stabilize the hillside. And then we will install the sewer, water, and electricity to the 6 home sites on this first half of that property.
The Sitka CLT presented its plan to the Assembly last summer when it asked to purchase the site for $1. Mayor Mim McConnell is the CLT's executive director, but even without her participation, the assembly liked the idea. As Huey says, this isn't a low-income housing project, it's a medium-income housing opportunity.
Our plan is that the largest home is around 1,100 square foot, three-bedroom house. It can be done. And, you know, somewhere around 900 square foot for a two-bedroom and 700 square foot for a one-bedroom home, and a mixture of one-, two-, and three-bedroom homes.
Ultimately, there will be as many as 13 homes on the property if these first six prove successful. Buyers who invest in a Sitka Land Trust cottage are also investing in a slightly different lifestyle than they may be used to.
It's also called a cottage neighborhood, not just because the homes are small, but because they are arranged inwardly towards each other with porches facing a common green, and parking is held to the outside of the neighborhood, so suddenly people are living together in a little neighborhood in the way that most architecture on most streets in America do not do.
And the other difference from most streets in America is that in a land trust, you own only the building you live in, not the land under it. That's the single biggest reason these cottages will be priced either side of $200,000. The other difference with a land trust, you won't be able to leverage your low purchase price into big gains later. Excess profit is against the rules.
I think people's great concern, and it should be, is that the community land trust, in order to preserve affordability over time, limits profit taking at resale to 25% of the change in the assessed value. So you get to keep whatever you put down, and you keep whatever you bought by paying payments, and then you get 25% of the change in the appraised value.
Huey describes buying a land trust property as climbing onto the first rung of a ladder. Eventually, you'll move up and leave that first rung available for the next person. It's an altruistic idea in a society that places a lot of value on generating wealth through real estate. But he thinks the cottage homes will be the perfect fit for someone. What hasn't been a great fit, however, is the Sitka CLT's first project, a three-bedroom house on Lillian Drive.
We, as a group, made too big of a home. You know, we needed to be tighter with some things, and we weren't.
The Lillian Drive house is no cottage, and priced at $250,000, it might push the envelope of affordability. Nevertheless, Huey thinks the right buyer will understand the logic of the investment.
So the price, even though it's above where we intended to be, is still right in range with what people are spending to rent a three-bedroom house in Sitka. So the terms of purchasing are so favorable right now, with very low interest rates, very low down. People who are thinking about making the plunge really should have a good hard look at the Lillian Drive house.
In the meantime, Huey hopes to be building cottages by next spring. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Four researchers from New Mexico and Denmark are visiting Haines and Juneau to find out more about Alaska Native identity. They're interested in what they say is a complex but understudied area of research, how Tlingit and other Alaska Native people view themselves, their culture, and their community. The identity study is funded by the National Science Foundation and supported by Sea Alaska's Heritage Institute. Emily Files talked to the research team and has this report from Haines.
One of the lead investigators in this identity study has a personal connection to the area. Caitlin Stern grew up in Haines.
Yeah, so I've always wanted to learn more about Native culture, and I was really excited to have the opportunity to come back to Haines and do that.
Now Stern is a fellow at the Santa Fe Institute in New Mexico. She's teamed up with another Santa Fe researcher, Vanessa Ferdinand, and two peers from the Aarhus Institute in Denmark, Jesse Barker and Juke Velthaus.
A major reason that we wanted to work with Tlingit people is that Their notions of identity are so interesting and complex and not very well understood by other people, I think. So people can have their clan identity within clans. There are houses that people might identify with. There's also the layers of people's moieties, their villages.
Stern says they want to learn how all those different layers influence people's identity, how they connect with their culture, and their social behavior, how they relate to and rely on others. Here's Barker.
And we think this is a really exciting time to be kind of here and talking to Tlingit people with so much kind of effort being put in recently into kind of perpetuating Alaska Native culture with traditional knowledge camps. We're going down to Celebration next week, so we're really excited to see all the dance groups performing there.
Velthaus says this study could support programs that teach and continue traditional practices.
If we find that for half of our participants, their language, their roots are within their language and language programs, that might then inform decisions on how many resources a community gives to these language programs. Of course, it might be art, it might be something else.
Velthaus says she helped conduct a similar study in Papua New Guinea, looking at how locations influence people's identities and stress levels.
One of the things that I found was that people in more remote locations, even though they might not have the material wealth of people in more urban locations, were generally much happier and doing much better than a lot of their peers who had moved to the bigger cities.
The research team is hoping to talk to as many Alaska Native people as possible. They're expecting to hear from mostly Tlingit people, but they're also interested in Haida, Tsimshian, and other cultures. All the participants will be kept anonymous.
We are really eager to hear from everyone.
They're gathering feedback in a few ways, through an online survey, paper surveys at the Haines Library, and follow-up interviews in person. Each participant is paid $15. The team has already talked to a number of people, and the renewed interest in Native culture stands out.
This is something people are want to get. It's a message they also are keen to talk about, keen to get out there. In part, especially with the older people that I'm interviewing, that hasn't always been possible. And it feels to me that this reinvigoration is partially people's opportunity to catch up and connect, and in times also reconnect. That's something we are seeing a lot, people reconnecting with their culture and having a deep appreciation of what it has to offer.
The researchers say the more people they hear from, the stronger information they'll have. They hope their findings won't just be interesting to read, but have practical implications for communities. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Alaska Native people living anywhere in the state are invited to participate in the study. For more information about that, there's an email and a telephone number. You can contact us here at KFSK, and we will give you those. This wraps up KFSK's Midday Magazine. I'm Angela Denning. Thanks for listening.